Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 380.PS6831, certificate number 19722, the Dreadnought Hoax.
Are you much of a practical joker? You've never played a practical joke on me that I can remember.
This might have come up before, because I dislike practical jokes.
On what ground?
That they essentially just involve lying to friends in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of practical jokes involve just a sustained lie, like, oh no, and now we can't go to dinner. We're going to have to go to some third place where I've planned a surprise party.
And that's not even really a practical joke or a hoax.
I know. That's like very benign, and I'm still like, ew.
Yeah.
Like imagine telling somebody like, you lost your job.
Uh-huh.
Just kidding.
As you're standing on the roof ready to jump off.
And in a lot of cases, the jokey, is there a name for that person?
I guess so.
The victim?
Victim.
The rube? Will often be like, no, this thing can't be happening. And you have to just continue to lie.
Yeah.
No, it is. You have to believe me. I'm continuing the practical joke. I'm continuing the lie I told with this follow-up lie that the first lie was not a lie.
Even the ones that are like, you won the lottery. It's like, oh, no, you didn't.
Yeah.
You know, neither one of
them. Are you going to like bring the person down only to relieve them? Or are you going to like make them happy only to disillusion them? I was friends with a practical joker once, and he did, and I may have said this on the show before, what I thought was a good practical joke, which is going outside somebody's apartment door, like putting up layers of butcher paper. And then as the layers go up, you also put blow up balloons and put them in the door.
Uh-huh.
So the prank lasts like 2.5 seconds as they open the door and suddenly balloons come at them where they expected the hallway to be. And it's a wonderful little kind of a moment of surrealism you've created for that person. You didn't get to enjoy it.
Right.
But you didn't have to like lie to them.
Right.
What's a good practical joke that is not a sustained lie?
I mean, I think that's pretty funny. A joke that you're not there to see, but
I would be fine being there.
Yeah, right. But I mean, I like the idea of like balloons falling on you, or suddenly it's a confetti cannon, or
I like it because it's short, it's harmless.
Yeah,
and the person immediately knows it's a joke. I guess is the main thing.
Yeah,
like the person immediately is like, a practical joke is happening to me and I like it, which is generally not true. And most practical jokes, for the duration of it, the victim does not know by definition.
We were, my daughter and I were playing Trivial Pursuit the other day. And it was
what year is it?
And it was a Trivial Pursuit game that had come out fairly recently that had questions for Greatest Generation. Not recently. And maybe the earliest questions were for Silent Generation people. And then there were
you
Boomer questions.
You and your
questions.
Daughter are playing Chaplin? Oh, I see.
And then there are Gen X questions, okay. Although they probably forgot to say Gen X on the box. And then Millennial questions, and then some even Gen Z questions. And because she's been raised by a nerd, like she has answers for a lot of questions that you wouldn't expect. I wouldn't expect.
She could do Gen X trivia and Millennial trivia?
Yeah, pretty well. But at one point, the question was, because a lot of them are kind of phrased in the spirit of Jeopardy. The question was, complete this sentence. Smile, you're on. And
fentanyl.
And she said, candid camera.
What?
And I said, do you know what candid camera is?
This has got to be a Garfield strip she read.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it was.
She knows a four-word phrase.
She couldn't remember where she had learned it. And she didn't know what candid camera was. And so I said, well, it was a TV show. And I explained the premise to her. And she was like, that sounds mean.
Wait, doesn't she know this from YouTube? I guess not giving her a smartphone has really paid off. Because yeah. I think the kids today watch the worst pranks of just people walking into an Arby's and being like, I want, I want a sundae or something. We don't have a sundae. Ha ha ha, you better make me a sundae. I don't know how this is a prank.
Yeah,
I don't, but there's hours of this stuff.
I know there is, and she's not interested in that because I think she considers that all gamer bro culture or
correct.
Something. And what she does watch YouTube all day, but it's YouTube videos of like, here's how the Suez Canal was built.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, she has not in high school yet, so she's...
Your plan to clone yourself into a small child has worked.
No, but she's not interested in my stuff. But she did know about candid camera, but when I explained some of the pranks that I remembered, she was just like, lame. That's not funny at all. And I was like, well, we used to laugh at when people fell down. Like so much comedy was just about people like hitting a door or falling down.
I had a friend where once if I was ever in the elevator with him and somebody came in, he would be like, and the rash went away, but I'm still contagious for 8 more days or whatever. And I just be
that
like,
stuff is funny-ish.
I think you realize, yeah. You know, like a dad joke has happened and now I'm in on it too,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I guess my experience of practical jokes was always reading about these incredibly elaborate, like, Caltech, Scientific American kind of practical jokes where you reassemble a World War II era Jeep in the dean's office over a weekend, or you
and we did that
somehow replace every flag on campus with the NATO flag. Or,
my high school the week of our graduation, and this is 1986, so long enough ago that there were still balloons and dirigibles in the sky. We went to the local Christian school, dismantled all of their playground equipment, broke into our high school, and reassembled it in the student center so that the next day...
Doesn't that seem funnier at your school than at their school where the playground is gone?
It was hilarious, and the problem was we didn't reveal... I mean, obviously, we were under tremendous scrutiny, and we're going to get in big trouble for this. But no one at our high school recognized the playground equipment from the Christian school, and the Christian school didn't know where it had gone. Well, assumed it had been stolen, and
they immediately forgave you.
They did. Well, they were no, they
they
were
turned
like,
the other cheek.
They were really like the mean Christians.
Oh, I see. They had it coming.
Yeah, they weren't the nice ones. And I don't remember exactly what process the grown-ups went through to discover that this belonged to another school, but it was several days.
I mean, I'm not Sherlock Holmes, but I think the first thing I would do was think, what school did this playground equipment come from?
But it could have been any park, you know?
I guess
that's. But yeah, that was an elaborate prank, and I'm afraid that I'm all drunk now, but I was so drunk then that I don't exactly remember how we pulled it off. Breaking into the school seems like it was even the greater crime. That you
did
would
anybody ever
for.
Get? Was there like threats of we're going to find out who did this, or was it like these senior pranks are out of control?
I mean, they were already threatening that I wouldn't graduate, and they had decided that they were going to do everything in their power to make sure I graduated. So one more thing wasn't going to like stop them. But there were other kids involved, and it doesn't even feel like the kind of prank I would organize. But you know, I was there with a wrench. But
this is definitely an arena where the whole modern obsession with punching up versus down is relevant because, you know, if I'm planting 6,000 ferns in the dean's office, I mean, take that, dean.
Yeah. Ha ha.
But
Mr. Man,
but you know, running into a bunch of bros with a successful channel, like terrorizing some Dairy Queen employee because who has to keep saying, but we don't have omelets. I mean, like
it does seem bogus. Right. What Mr. Beast does this all the time, right? He goes into some Japanese forest, and there's some kid that had committed suicide, and it's like, this isn't funny.
I'm 50 years old. I don't know what Mr. Beast does.
Yeah,
if you told me that all his things were culturally insensitive against the Japanese, I would believe it. But I thought he was just nice and just gave people checks.
I'm not sure. I was in a group of teenagers just yesterday, and I mentioned Mr. Beast, and then I got a varied response where some kids were like, Mr. Beast is dumb and corny, and other kids were like, he actually does a lot of good things. And then my daughter chimed in with like, Mr. Beast is lame. And then only later was like, I've never seen Mr. Beast. And I was like, you know, sweetheart, like that's exactly how not to approach things that you don't know anything about.
She knows how tribalism works.
Yeah.
Her friends don't like Mr. Beast. She has saved a step.
Yeah. She's like, I don't know. He plants trees or something.
It's much simpler.
But I have a friend that's a real practical joker. And I got practical joked last year. He was having a birthday party, and there's a right by your house in Woodland Park, there's a lawn bowling club. When you get off, you know where it is.
There's always a sign.
You have to turn. You have to turn really quickly because if you miss the turn, you have to go all the way back, get on 99 again.
The only way to get there is from 99.
Yeah, and it's this tiny little turn.
I don't know if I've ever seen anyone lawn bowling there.
It's a cute little mid-century modern clubhouse. It's a public sort of club. It's in the middle of a city park.
You just have to reserve the space. You don't have to pay dues.
I think you have to be a member. Okay. And it is, but it's like really cheap because who's lawn bowling? Anyway, this friend has a birthday party there and I missed the turn. And I have to go around and I decide rather than go all the way up, I'm going to park down at Woodland Park and we're going to climb up over the hill.
Yep.
So we come up over the hill and we see the lawn bowling thing. And the only people there are our friends who are kind of congregating, getting the bowling started. And there's the groundskeeper who is out on the very back corner of the farthest sort of area of the lawn bowling area. And he's got like some herbicide and he's like killing weeds out there. And so we set up
you're setting up an Agatha Christie mystery here. What's going to happen?
And we had to come in through a back gate, you know, cause we'd come on the wrong side. And we've got a buffet set up and a group of friends that have known each other for years. Our kids are all there and we start lawn bowling and we're chatting and, you know, an hour goes by. It's a warm day. And the groundskeeper is still like out along the fence sort of, you know, and he's in a hazmat suit with goggles and a respirator, and he's got it pulled over his head. And it's a hot day, and you know he's got to be sweating. And we all play for a while. We stop and have food. And then as he's making his way around the lawn bowling area, he starts spraying this herbicide around the clubhouse. And, you know, my friends are like, you can tell they're like, oh, this isn't, what's he doing? You know, there's a little bit of bumble, 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 bumble. Like he shouldn't be spraying that around here. And he does it for a while and our kids are running around. And eventually I say, because of course I'm this guy, I'm like, hey, hello, my friend. Do you think that you could not spray the insecticide here where we're eating? And he says, oh, you know, in a kind of ambiguous accent, like, oh, Mr. Mike says I have to, you know, this is a job that Mr. Mike says I have to do. And I was like, well, I'm pretty sure that I can talk to Mr. Mike for you and say that we had to reserve the club and it's not a good time for you to be spraying insecticide. And he gets kind of upset and he's like, Mr. Mike, you know, I have to do this.
This is not meeting my prank should be short and not awkward.
This is now, this is well over an hour that this has been happening. And his tub of insecticide or herbicide has a big skull and crossbones on it. And I said, and my friends are all kind of like cowering and mumbling. And I said, well, you know, you can see, right? You're wearing a respirator and a hazmat suit and goggles and your thing here has poison written right on the side. And I point to all the kids and I point to the food and I say, you can understand why I wouldn't want you to be spraying this around the food and the family. And he's like, oh, but Mr. Mike said, and I said, listen, I'm very confident that I can get a hold of Mr. Mike. So he kind of wanders off and we get back to our picnic. And then I look out and he's back and he's spraying like right where we're eating. And I go back out and all my friends are like, oh, this is, you know, what the hell? And they're kind of calling their
kids. Good thing you were there.
I know.
Designated extrovert survivor.
This is the problem, right? And I'm conscious of this. I'm like, oh, why am I the guy that's doing this like this? Why everybody else is just calling their kids in and shutting the door and I'm the one that has to be. So I go back out and I'm like, hey, I know that you understood what I was saying and now you're spraying like right in our area. And I really, really need you to stop doing this. And I will call Mr. Mike and tell him that I'm the problem here. And the guy's like, again, just sort of like, you know, passively just trying to keep doing his thing. And I'm having all these emotions about like, here's an immigrant guy just trying to get his job done. He's going to get paid some amount, but he has to finish it. He's really committed to the thing.
This is a social science experiment and a practical joke.
Yeah. And I'm like, I will ensure that you get paid for this work. I will give the money myself to Mr. Mike. Stop spraying poison on the patio where our children are trying to play. And he, right in front of me, goes psht and sprays a bunch of stuff. And I say, that's enough. Like, I am telling you right now to stop doing this. And he says, okay, and he walks away and then turns around and psht again. And I go into my place where I was like, I'm mad. And I say, stop it. And, you know, and my friends and their wives are all like, oh no, you know. And I walk over and he sprays me. Like right in the, psht, just right in the face. And I had some sandwich or something and I lost my mind and I hucked my sandwich at him and I went at him. At which point the guy who had set up the guy whose birthday party it was, jumped in between us, you know, holding me around the, you know, the shoulders like, no, stop, stop, stop. It's Chris. It's Chris. And the guy takes off his mask and it's my former bandmate and good friend that I haven't seen in years, Chris Cornelia, who had come up from Portland specifically for this prank. And no one else had known about it.
So it wasn't a prank on you. It was a prank on everyone.
It was a prank on
everyone. It assumed that you would become the... And did everyone there know, like, were they all friends of Chris Cornelia's?
Chris was one of our oldest friends.
So it was a big surprise to everyone that he was there.
And it was a big reveal. Chris is here! Like, everybody was so excited to see Chris. But also, it was a huge prank, and Brian and Chris had taken odds. Like, who do you think is going to be the one that finally, like...
takes the poison in the face.
Finally can't take it anymore. And Chris said to Brian, is Roderick going to be there? Because it's for sure going to be Roderick. And I was like, you know, and it took me a minute to calm down. And I was embarrassed that I was ready to throw this guy in a pond. And yet everybody else was like, well, you're the only one that did anything. And he sprang poison on our kids. So it was like, we can see, like, Brian was very nice. And like, you did exactly what you should have done or what I would have done. And I still was like,
it didn't immediately ease all the tension that the prank had created.
Well, it did for everybody else, except you could see the other dads were now a little ashamed because this had clearly been a prank to see who would stand up for the group. And everybody else had kind of just mumbled and whispered and, you know, kind of passively. But it haunted me.
I'm going to rule against this prank.
I've talked about this prank before, and the consensus of people has been, that's a dirty trick.
That's not a good prank.
But it took me the rest of the day to calm down.
That's
but
what my bell is now for, is for when I hear about an unapproved prank.
Dirty prank.
That's what I use my bell for.
But, you know, because it
you're
causes
kind of throwing
me,
Brian under the bus here.
It causes, well, Brian is a prankster. Think about how long it took him to, he had to buy a hazmat suit. He drew a skull and crossbones on he probably paid $90 for all the stuff. Plus he put Chris Cornelio on a train to bring him up. Like this is kind of Brian's genius. But
I don't think that's genius.
It got to
like
the
if all
heart
that
of,
energy went to like cool holiday decorations at his house,
I guess so.
Then do that.
He's the one that lives in your neighborhood that has the giant skeleton.
That's what I was wondering.
He has the giant skeleton. But yeah, it was like somehow that's the part of me that I'm always trying to regulate. Like, don't start disciplining some teenager that's got, you know, that's hassling.
Don't be a Karen.
You know, I'm definitely not a Karen, but I am like the one that's going to enforce the law in a public space if
that's
somebody's hassling.
Called,
no, it's not. If a kid is like hassling a woman with a stroller or something. You know, I'm the one that's like, well, nobody's doing anything, so somebody's got it. I don't complain to managers.
You're not Karen. You're Batman.
I'm Batman, but I don't. But I also know, like, I don't. You know, maybe a little bit less of a Batman.
Is Batman a Karen? Hey, guys, I've been noticing you really shouldn't be unloading all these guns down at the dock. Have you seen the rules about that? Like, it can't be you kids. Who's actually in charge here?
The time immediately before this prank, I was in a restaurant and there was a guy, we were out on the patio. There was a guy who had a little yappy dog and he let the dog stand on his table. And I said,
you're Larry David.
Yeah, I was.
On behalf
I was like,
of all of us.
I said, hey, people are going to eat at that table. And he said, it's my table, I can do what I want. And I said, no, but your dog has shit on its paws, and you're going to leave, and they're going to give it a cursory wipe down. I'm talking on behalf of the people that are coming. It is totally Larry David. On behalf of the
people
future,
the next day.
The future generations, like, get your dog off the table. And he's, like, older than me. He's 65. And at one point I said, your dad fought in World War II, so you can have your dog on the table? And, man, my daughter's like, Dad, God, why are you doing this? So, anyway, but it was, yeah, for sure a practical joke and one that,
it was particularly ill-chosen for you, but everybody in your situation would have a bad time with that. It's not like most people would enjoy this, but he got unlucky and got you.
I mean, my friends were all ashamed of themselves, so there was no middle ground, right?
He got to enjoy it for an hour, apparently.
He was, and that was the genius of it. He sat out there sweating in the sun for an hour and a half setting up this
I don't
joke.
Mean Chris, I mean Brian got to enjoy it.
Oh, I mean, Brian was enjoying it for a
but
week.
But you're like a some kind of supervillain if you're like, I'm the only one here having a good time. Cat giggles to self.
He is a supervillain. And he videotaped the whole thing. So he replayed it and like posted it and all this stuff. He was really into it. Anyway.
Is he going to hear that we're like kind of slagging on him? No, because I live down the street from him.
Well, no.
I don't want his giant skeleton coming after me.
In fact,
love his giant skeleton.
In telling this story, I think he would say, oh, that's an accurate retelling of the story. And I think he would feel pretty proud to be entered into the omnibus.
Because that's the prankster's code.
Yeah. He would say, well, I don't know. Pretty cool, actually. I mean, you know, when was your last cool prank that made somebody lose their head?
Yeah, I think I'm against 95% of all pranks.
Well, I don't know how you're going to feel about today's prank.
Today's, what if that was our show?
Today's
prank.
Well,
we've come to today's prank.
Is that your chair has been hooked to a generator.
No!
In the 19th century, and in the 18th century too, but in the 19th century in particular, among the Victorians and the Edwardians...
That would be more in the 19th century then.
Well, you know,
were fewer of them in the 18th century.
They were all very. I think the 19th century pranksters were kind of influenced by that sort of Enlightenment era, like, oh, let's put the fossils of a platypus and a giraffe together and see. See who believes it's a new animal.
I guess I've never thought much about historical pranking.
Yeah.
Like, were the Babylonians doing elaborate things?
It does seem like
I killed all your crops 6 months ago. Why are you still waiting?
It seems like a kind of mind, right? A type of person that would recognize the comedic value in making somebody. I mean, all jokes are subverting expectations,
and many jokes have a but.
Right, and so this seems like a kind of like I don't have a mind for puns, and I also don't have a mind for devious, like stringing somebody along and then a big reveal.
I wonder if it, even if it's, in addition to having to be invented, I wonder if it's culturally mediated. I wonder if there are cultures that would, like, you would do a prank today and they would be like, what just happened? They wouldn't be like, oh, a prank, you got me.
I mean, there certainly are cultures that tease much more than other cultures. I mean, I am a natural teaser.
Yeah, we have a kid. Yeah, I think I've said this before. I'm a teaser as a parent.
Yeah.
And my kids roll their eyes, but we have a niece who has never been teased. So it's really like just taking somebody with no antibodies and dropping them into a plague. Because, you know, whatever I say to this kid, she'll just kind of like blink at me with big blue eyes.
Well, I don't know if you remember, but in the very early days of the Omnibus, there was someone who moderated our Facebook group who had come from a Stuff You Should Know Facebook culture, and who was like, I love Omnibus and I'm going to start moderating the Facebook group. But she really liked you and didn't like me.
She seems great and normal.
I know. She was a very normal person. But at one point, I said something to you during a show about like, well, you know, I'm kind of a teaser and my daughter is 8 years old and I routinely tell her that, oh, well, you know, if we don't make it to school on time, then you're not going to be able to go to school anymore and you're going to end up working on a farm. Yeah. And my daughter, who is pretty literal at that age, was like, what? And I'm like, you're not actually going to work on it. And I retold some story like that. And this woman who was our Facebook moderator went on our own Facebook page and said, you know, I think that this is cruel. Like, and then there were a couple of other people that came on and were like, well, my daughter is, I'm a great father and I would never tease my daughter. And she now is a scientist.
She was the first person to Bean Dad you.
Yeah. And I think when
you should have listened to her,
at one point during Bean Dad, I was like, you know what? I bet that particular woman from the early days of Facebook, I bet she's
like,
really
gloating. I knew it. Yeah. I knew it.
Yeah. It's exactly right. And she ended up saying, I don't want to moderate the Omnibus Facebook page anymore because it's a hostile environment.
If I can't criticize the parenting of the thing I'm a fan of, am I even a fan?
But as a teaser, I know you to be a teaser also, it's very natural. It doesn't feel weird at all. It feels friendly.
I'm a pretty benign teaser. Yeah. You know, if the kid is like, what's in this thing they're poking at? And I'm like, That's all octopus. Yeah. They'll just be like, no, it's not. We're at McDonald's. It's not octopus.
And my kid, too, now assumes that everything I say is like, a lie. Is it really? Is that box really full of snakes? And then she opens a box and it is full of snakes.
That's always good parenting when they assume you're a liar. I did it.
Lol. If you think about the 19th century in particular, there was a lot of new science. There were a lot of culpable or credible people. There was a lot of journalism. There were a lot of opportunities for people to kind of hoax. Like Edgar Allan Poe has like seven major hoaxes that when they were stories, but that they were initially published and they were news items.
One thing about journalism is you could just make stuff up. Mark Twain used to do this too. Yeah. I guess they all turned into great writers, so we just have to suck it up.
And later on, it's like, oh, that was just a story. Like, I'm a fiction writer. But he did it over and over, you know?
I feel like I would fire Poe from the newsroom.
And when you think about, like...
did this bat really kill six people?
Think about War of the Worlds. I mean, that was... Yeah. We still talk about that hoax. And also, not really funny, right? Given the amount of chaos ensued.
But I think also not intended... Maybe as a hoax.
Oh, right.
Like if you're Orson Welles and you like metafiction, he's just kind of, I'll do a science fiction drama, but it'll sound like breaking news.
Right.
But no one will think Martians are invading. I don't think he was trying to trick us.
No, and a lot of it does
require... He was trying to trick us later on the Dick Cavett show with his close-up magic. But in the 30s, he was not trying to trick us with Martians.
It does require that you misjudge your audience's...
Yeah.
Or you perfectly judge your audience's either like major blind spots or just sort of like credulity.
Skeleton Guy didn't misjudge. He got what he wanted. Like... An hour of weirdness and then 20 minutes of awkwardness. An hour of mystery and an hour of suspense to him and then 20 minutes of awkwardness.
Well, and like you were saying, like a strange social experiment, like a 1960s social experiment where now none of us can look at each other. None of us can look each other in the eye. And we're all established as like, well, here's your character when the shit hits the fan.
When I read about those Milgram obedience tests or whatever, the Stanford Prison Experiment, I'm just like, these are just pranks, essentially. Like, it's a sustained lie, and when the person answers back and says, objects, you have a series of responses,
yeah.
You know, and that's how the hoaxer operates, too. It's a good one.
What's interesting about all those science experiments, or the Milgram experiments, is that they always say, well, 89% of the people fell for it, but they never talk about the 11% who were like, nah, I just don't, this is
11% were really like, I bet that's not a shock thing.
Yeah, I bet you this whole thing is fake. Or and sometimes
they were ahead of their time. They were like the pre-cynical Gen Xers.
And whether or not it's like during that one experiment with that 11%, the person made a sideways glance with their eyes that gave them away.
The proctor was very unconvincing.
Or whether it's just that 11% of the people are like, this would never happen. And just kind of think it through. Because so many pranks involve that you suspend a certain amount of disbelief.
But people are so susceptible to what they're told a situation is.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, I guess, like, you just hear stories about, like, well, I guess I'll just sit here because I've been told to. You know, no.
The water's rising in the room.
You should get out of there, man.
And I don't know what that is. I mean, I have never said about myself, oh, I would never fall for any of those. Because, of course, you assume you're going to fall for anything.
I would fall for all. They're all constructed so that you would. Nobody sets up a prank where it's like 2/3 of the people are going to see what's up here.
Yeah, they're not ever presented as intelligence tests, right? they're set up as like, we're going to lie to you.
If you're the Riddler or something, get out of my death trap, Batman.
Well, the thing about the pranks, and a lot of prank culture was in the UK because, it's very in keeping with a sort of UK sense of humor. And it's very much about skewering. A ton of pranks kind of get at skewering pompous people.
That's how you generate this in a class system where you don't have other options.
And in America, of course, as we know, there are no pompous people. We're all just salt of the earth. Just everybody is pretty much equal.
Perfect democracy.
And we all have, you know... sort of the same education, but in the UK, obviously there's a pretty rigid, even now, pretty rigid class system. The thing is that most of these pranks, the prominent ones, the ones that we still talk about, not that a regular person still talks about, but that somebody that reads the encyclopedia might still talk about, are just upper class aristocrats from Eton pulling pranks on other upper class aristocrats that were like duller.
You have to have free time and you have to have access to pomposity.
Right.
And a factory worker does not have either.
Yeah. A factory worker isn't going to get something published in the Daily Mail. A factory worker doesn't have the resources to set up an elaborate, you know, thing where some housewife is bamboozled into, you know, showing up at the Queen's house with an engraved invitation.
I have free time and access to pomposity. I guess I should be doing pranks on behalf of all the voiceless who cannot.
Yeah, who are some of the most pompous people in your life that you feel like? I mean, I would assume working in Hollywood. I know you. I don't want to get you in trouble with anybody at the studio, but I would assume that you would come in contact with a lot of people that maybe don't have the same sophisticated sense of humor that you do.
But which of them could fire me? That's what you have to stay away from, right? You don't want you can't prank where you eat,
right?
I have to go to some restaurant where some famously stuffy and unlikable celeb is eating, and then figure out my revenge.
But is it a type of thing that you would pull on another celebrity, or would you pull it on somebody that worked in the Hollywood system that was making it hard to be clever?
I guess agents, right?
Yeah, agents.
That's what we should do. Pranks on entertainment industry agents. They're probably not all the brightest. They're keeping 10% of people's income, you know, without probably.
Yeah, right. Pretty easy to.
From an air-conditioned desk on Santa Monica Boulevard.
One of the earliest pranks that really makes it into the canon of pranks happened in 1810. It was called the Berners Street Hoax. And it involved, again, the usual sort of English men of letters, a man by the name of Theodore Hook, who was sitting with a friend in 1810 and made what seemed to the friend to be a spontaneous bet that he could turn any house in London within a week's time, could turn any anonymous house in London into the most famous house in the country. And it seemed like one of these.
These are setups for short stories, but they happened in real life too.
Yeah.
People would just sit around and make weird wagers.
Yeah. And he's a writer. Hook was a writer. So this is the kind of, you know, this is all a very sort of a bored Cambridge people with a lot of money. And so the friend, and it's one of these trading places bets where it's like, I bet you £5 that I can do. You know, I can do this bizarre and seemingly impossible thing. So the friend is like, yeah, sure. I mean, I'll take that bet. Like, and he kind of, you know, swings his finger around and says, that house right there, 54 Berners Street. I'm going to make it the most famous house in all of London.
The other guy should have been able to pick the house.
That's right.
That would make the prank.
That would be a better prank, right? But he picks the house. And then because they're wealthy and also because this was a real, like, elaborately planned ruse, Hook actually is able to rent an apartment across the street from this address, 54 Berners, and he invites a group of friends over the following day to sit in this, you know, apartment and watch out the window as he miraculously makes 54 Berners Street the most famous house in London. Everybody's friends show up and they're like, what could this possibly be? And starting in the early part of the day, like 5 o'clock in the morning, and crazily, like, he was able to get all of his friends over there, like, 5 a.m., like, everybody get here at 4 because I want to show you this whole thing. 5 a.m., like, a chimney sweep shows up and knocks on the door. And the woman who answers is just a woman, not connected to Hook at all. And the chimney sweep shows up and says, you know, I'm here to clean this chimney as you hired me to do. And she said, I didn't hire a chimney sweep.
Plus it's 5 a.m. you said?
5 in the morning, which is when, you know, that's
is
when.
Is that chimney sweep o'clock?
That's chimney sweep o'clock. But as the chimney sweep is standing there, another chimney sweep arrives and says, I was hired to sweep the chimney. And as you can see, this is the great grandfather of YouTube pranksters.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just 4chan sending a bunch of pizzas.
Yeah.
They're doxing this woman, except the point is not that the woman has done anything wrong or that she is, you know, that she has no.
She does do a lot of the emotional labor of the prank, though.
Well, at first she does. But then a coal wagon rolls up and says, you know, I'm here to deliver the coal. And as the coal wagon shows up, more coal wagons show up. And pretty soon the street is jammed with a dozen horse-drawn coal wagons, followed by a dozen butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers all showing up with their wares, like, you ordered three wedding cakes. This is all still in the morning. And then it's just a deluge. Furniture reupholsterers, fishmongers, and the crowd, they were all scheduled to come just close enough on one another's heels that someone arrives and is still trying to grok what's happening, and they're blocked in by the next person that's arriving. So pretty soon, out in front of this address, the street is completely jammed. And some people think it's funny. A lot of the tradespeople have brought these perishable items. You know, they've carried fish on a cart all the way from the Thames, expecting a banquet, and now they're standing there, you know, with wedding cakes falling, and then, you know, the chairman of the Bank of England arrives because he's been asked to come meet this infirm woman to talk about her estates. And like undertakers show up with coffins. I guess 40 butchers, 50 pastry chefs, the Lord Mayor of London.
Ooh, some of these are good gets.
Pretty good gets.
And it goes all day. He could have picked any house, actually.
Rabbits, pigeons.
He could have just said, you pick a house and I'll make it the most famous house in London.
And then like maids and butlers answering ads that had been put in the newspaper for domestic servants. Mm. And what it turned out was that he had been writing letters for weeks. He sent out 4,000 letters like preparing all of this to, you know, send it out to everything he could possibly imagine in order to like create this. And by the end of the day, it was all of London had come to a screeching halt, and this was famous throughout the country, and he'd won his whatever it was, £5 bet.
But he probably had to pay for all the stuff, so it probably didn't cost him.
Well, no, I think it was like they had all arrived with their things and expected to be paid for the wedding cakes.
Well,
he
hadn't bought them in advance. That's a problem.
Well, this is why we can't have nice things, Ken, because now you want your wedding cake money up front because of this guy.
Well, I feel this prank has so many victims then. I thought I was just the aggrieved lady of the house. No, it's all these people who like lost their day's trade because they brought all their fish to a house that didn't want it.
Yeah, it was super mean. And at least in the retelling of the story, the woman who lived in the house thought it was hilarious because it was all just happening out in the street in front of her house. She stopped answering the door, I'm sure. And after not very long, nobody could even make it to the door. They just kept piling up on the streets. If you think about all these people, like they were all a lot of carts. There was no getting out of this traffic jam. Man. And he split town right after and spent a few weeks like out in the countryside, was never prosecuted for it. He was just sort of like known amongst his friends as the legendary guy that had done it. And then it became like a meme,
like TPing a tree,
and people repeated it in other cities. It happened on the European continent.
At least the first time it's novel.
Well, but then it becomes a comic.
Yeah, but when a bad prank happens to you, you're like, oh, it's not even what's happening. It's like, oh no, this, and
oh,
now it's
no,
me. It's like
not this.
It's like getting a cancer diagnosis.
And it probably is exactly why we can't have nice things, because it then became a bit. And then it became like a bit that animated musicals and novels. Like it was a kind of bit within the culture. He lived until the 1840s, but
hope he was killed by an angry fishmonger.
Yeah, exactly. And no one like the woman whose house it was named Mrs. Tottenham, and she appeared to have no connection to him at all. She was just a wealthy woman, and I think that was part of the thing. The house was the house of a rich woman. Otherwise, who would bring 400 fish to a
right
to just anybody's house? It was, you know, it was on a prominent street.
But you do have the idle rich laughing at and victimizing the poor for the prank to work, or at least the working class.
Oh, 100%. Everybody
those
that
chimney sweeps.
Everybody that got screwed was somebody that, you know, that was really hoping that today was the day that was going to put their kids through school. And instead, they're out there with 400 rotting fish and 18 coffins. And
I almost think he doesn't nail kind of the Man Ray surrealistic potential of it, which would have been just 150 chimney sweeps. Like,
right?
It was, isn't it more pure if, like, if the story is like, and then 102 wedding cakes showed up?
I mean, I wonder how many coffin mongers there were in 1810 London. I think
word would get around.
You probably reached, although the funny thing would have been to send them to the Lord Mayor of London's house rather than this poor woman. But that would have given away one of the elements of his
and
pranks.
Possibly would have got Scotland Yard on you.
Yeah, exactly.
On your tail. I just feel bad for all the mongers in this story.
I know you're a monger lover.
I'm a man of the people, and I support the mongers. We need them monging.
I support the mongers.
They don't get paid enough for all the things they mong.
Hear, hear.
They should not be pranked. Stop pranking the mongers.
Well, now, so throughout the 19th century.
Except for rumor mongers, by the way.
Oh, rumor mongers.
Fishmongers and ironmongers, leave them alone. But rumor mongers?
Rumor mongers. Hate mongers.
Exactly. Hate mongers is okay.
I don't, well, you're saying it's cool to prank
turn
hate mongers
the eye of your,
and rumor mongers.
Turn the eye of your prank on hate mongers and rumor mongers only.
Right.
No other mongering. All other mongering must be protected.
Protected mongering.
Right.
So throughout the 19th century.
Sorry to ruin your segue.
No, I mean, you actually distracted me with thinking of all the kinds of mongers there are.
There's fewer than you think. There's cheese.
Cheesemongers.
You can't monger everything.
I think you can put monger on the end of a lot more things than we typically do.
It would be pretty funny if every job was that. Like if you worked at Boeing, you were a plane monger.
Yeah, guitar monger or a. Yeah, exactly.
Get your guitar monger. That's what
appliance
you could
monger.
You could call your roadies guitar mongers.
Guitar monger. Well, they're not selling you the things.
What is mongering? I don't even know.
I think mongering is like it's trading in the thing.
Do you have to make it? Like is a cheesemonger is making cheese, but a retailer would not be a cheesemonger?
No, I think it's just like a dealer. Like mongering is to deal. So you would be
correct.
A furniture monger or a doily monger.
So you don't have to make the thing.
You don't have to make the thing. No. I mean, a fishmonger doesn't make the fish. God makes the fish.
I'm a quizmonger.
You are a quizmonger.
It's a terrible word.
Well, so throughout the 19th century, this was considered a kind of, I mean, a milder one. Nobody really, no Cambridge freshman really wants to spend 6 weeks spending all this time and money to put together a prank like this, but they do want to prank each other. It's a kind of a typical thing to do in the popular press. It's a thing for writers to do to gain attention. It's just part of what you would expect if you were living in London and part of an erudite sect. And, you know, Cambridge University at this point is sort of a hotbed for a certain kind of young literary person, man, because Cambridge was not a hotbed of young literary women at the time. And there was a group at Cambridge actually called the Apostles.
Oh, yeah.
It was an invite-only group that originally had only 12 members. That's why it was called the Apostles.
Well, and a little full of themselves.
That's right. Well, I mean, you can see why they might be, because the original group of apostles included Bertrand Russell and Alfred Lord Tennyson, and they were.
I thought it was like a gay set.
Well, so that's the thing. The apostles were a place where there was a kind of unapologetic homosexuality that they gave themselves an out for. They described it as higher sodomy, meaning that it wasn't gay. It was a Greek level. It was sodomy at the level of male friendship and bonding.
You get to be gay and you get to be homophobic at the same time.
That's right. And I don't understand.
You're laughing at all those other dirty sodomists that couldn't get into Cambridge.
This was, you know, this was the Oscar Wilde kind of one of the things that played into the trial of Oscar Wilde was that there was an openly gay culture in the UK at this time. It was just coded with all of these special rules, all these private clubs, all this higher sodomy.
Thank goodness for ancient Greece giving us an out.
And a lot of the prominent, people also had wives and children. So, but affairs with one another. I mean, it was very much what you would think of as an aristocratic sense of their entitlement to basically do and be whoever they wanted to be.
You're making that sound good when the rich do depraved things like.
If it wasn't for the depraved rich, Ken, well, I wouldn't have any of the things that I've managed to collect over the years. Like my costume that I'm wearing right now, this button-down shirt and khaki pants are basically like what someone would have worn to play tennis in 1920.
Thank goodness for them.
Thank goodness for them. They gave us all of preppy style. The rest of us, we'd just be wearing dungarees.
Dungarees right now.
What would a rich person be wearing? You know, some kind of spats and
a top hat.
Right. How inconvenient in Seattle, especially.
I'm sure they left their top hats on when they were cheating on their wives with their
100%. I can't think of anything hotter. Why is there not a whole subset of gay porn where it's just men in top hats and tails?
That's what higher sodomy is. Like you're taller because of your top hat. It's taller sodomy.
Taller sodomy. We're introducing a character by the name of Horace Devere Cole, who was the son of an Indian civil servant. I mean, a civil servant in British India.
In India.
Yeah, who died in India. And he was Irish, and he came from a wealthy family. His grandfather had cornered the market on quinine during the era of British colonial expansion that would have introduced malaria into large portions of the colonial population. So being the quinine dealer was a quick route to fame and fortune.
And they had it all.
They did.
People probably died because they could jack up the price on quinine to whatever they liked.
It's just like whatever the current terrible thing that drug companies are doing right now.
The Sacklers of their day.
And so he went to Cambridge. He fought in the Boer War. And was an English gentleman, right? A captain in the army, and was gravely wounded and still probably like Flashman, probably 18 years old, and uses his disability money to go to Cambridge. He becomes a kind of, at the time, the expectation for gentlemen at Cambridge and Oxford was not at all that they would study hard and graduate.
It wasn't.
No. And
you were just there to stay out of trouble?
No, you were there to get into trouble. You were there to join prominent clubs.
It's like Rumspringa.
Yeah. But also meet the other aristocrats who would then give you a job in banking, or you would know them in the House of Lords, or, you know, it was the old boy network in the ancient sense. I mean, if you think about all the great capitalists of our day that went to Harvard, they all dropped out. It's still as much a badge of honor to have gone and left without a degree.
Because they're not there for the degree.
They're not there for the degree.
I got the connections.
They don't need the degree.
I know all the drunk offspring of everybody in America.
They
can leave.
Already going to inherit the big house. They just needed, you know, to know their neighbors.
Got it.
And so he was a member of, you know, drinking clubs and various, various sort of social circles that included a lot of the apostles of their day.
So he wasn't an apostle.
No, he wasn't himself an apostle. He made friends with a fellow undergraduate named Adrian Stephen, who happened to be the brother of Virginia Woolf.
Oh, yeah.
Before she was Virginia Woolf. That's right. The Stephen family, who were prominent and literary and fun-loving, but also respectable. And at one point, I mean, respectable as bohemians, but this was an era. I mean, Horace was born in 1881. So we're talking about fin de siècle, turn of the century, early 1900s.
We're getting more into kind of like bright young things, Wodehouse territory, which is which is what I was kind of picturing when you were talking about your pranksters of the 1820s. I was like, wow, these guys are idle rich, dopey idle rich ahead of their time. They don't even have cars yet.
And that is, I mean, that is really, so most of the cast, I mean, these are the people, a lot of them who went on to form the Bloomsbury Group, who I will probably do another episode of The Omnibus on maybe really soon.
Because you have, all the research at hand?
I've been reading about the Bloomsbury Group now for 5 days, and I was like, I should mention that our episode today is derived from a suggestion by a Patreon subscriber.
Listener named Brandon, who donated a tier where he could suggest a show.
That's right.
And he loves the Dreadnought Hoax.
He does.
Which I had not heard of.
No, and the Dreadnought Hoax is a...
good omnibus choice.
Is a good omnibus choice, and it is just adjacent enough to the Bloomsbury Group that I went down a rabbit hole because of attention deficit disorder. I was like, huh, Virginia Woolf's younger brother, eh? And then pretty soon, it was 4 days later, and I was like, whoa, get back to the Dreadnought Hoax.
Is this the rare two-part omnibus?
Oh, maybe it could be.
It's never happened.
The thing about the Bloomsbury Group is they are, certain members are tangentially involved. Cole was never officially a member of the Bloomsbury Group. And of course, they all claimed there was no such thing. But we'll talk about that in this future episode we're going to do.
The first rule of Bloomsbury Group.
Along with Adrian Stephen, Horace comes up with this hilarious prank. They're all sitting around, I'm sure, drunk. And at that point in time, the Sultan of Zanzibar.
Whoa, what a twist. I didn't think that sentence was going to suddenly turn into a sultan.
Here comes the Sultan of Zanzibar, a man by the name of Sayyid Ali bin Hamoud al Busaid. This is 1905. He's visiting London.
Ah.
And the Sultan, like Zanzibar at this point, you know, it's always been part of the Sultanate of Muscat and Oman, which is
closer to the African coast,
so far away from those places. But as part of the Omani empire, they are Arabic speaking.
This explains Freddie Mercury somehow, right?
Wasn't he a Zoroastrian?
But wasn't he a Zoroastrian from Zanzibar?
Oh, so from Zanzibar.
Or am I just assuming that because of the letter Z? A Zoroastrian from Zanzibar is like a made-up guy at the end of an alphabet book.
Yeah, right. Lowly Worm and Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, no, he was a Zoroastrian from Zanzibar. That's amazing.
And so Zanzibar was at this point, as was Oman, they were British protectorates and had been for a long time. So all of the, you know, all of whatever the complexity of Zanzibar would have already been full of Zoroastrians and also and Omani culture or Omani slash African culture, and then also part of the global British Empire.
Layer of colonialism on the top.
And here comes the Sultan of Zanzibar, and he's touring London. He's coming to England, and this is, you know, a big celebration or a big event.
Sure, a novelty and a dignitary.
And in 1905, you know, he would have been very exotic, but also all of the east coast of Africa would have been pretty well known to Britons, because this would have been, you know, Cecil Rhodes. This would have been an era when exploring Africa was really a thing that not all young gentlemen did, but
because Zanzibar is a British colony, this is kind of what the 20th century would later have is like a Commonwealth visit.
Yeah,
like
a visit of state.
It's a goodwill visit from our brethren from overseas.
Well, Horace de Vere Cole says, I think that we should tell the mayor of Cambridge that the Sultan is coming to visit Cambridge. And then we should appear dressed in Sultan's robes and see what we can get out of it. You know, just like prank this guy for no reason, just for fun.
What if like impersonating a sultan is its own crime with like a very long list of potential punishments?
It turns out it's not, but unfortunately, as they were plotting this, a picture of the sultan was published in the London Times. And so they kind of quickly changed their plan and presented themselves as...
Oh, I see. They knew they could not match the
phone. Yeah, I'm not, I can't be the Sultan of Zanzibar. But they went to a costume company. They got outfits that seemed like they might belong to the Sultan of Zanzibar. And then he portrayed himself as the uncle of the Sultan of Zanzibar. They arrived on a train car from London. They kind of went, you know, they drove up the road, got on the train car, arrived in Cambridge. They had alerted the mayor of Cambridge. He met them at the...
With like some kind of forged letters, I assume.
Yeah. And they got a tour of Cambridge in an open car with the mayor. And
they being Horace and just some of his friends.
Yeah. Well, no, just sort of Horace and Adrian.
Oh, okay. Just the two of them.
And I think maybe Adrian was acting as his
translator or whatever.
And then the gag had run its course. They didn't take it as far maybe as they could have.
Is there any big reveal? Is there a Mr. Mike moment?
What happens is they demand like, take us back to the train station. We must depart. Kind of just trying to find a way out. They get on the train. They went up to the next stop, got off. But the next day, Horace thought he was so hilarious that he revealed his whole gag to the Daily Mirror.
Yeah, it's not a prank if only you know.
Yeah, and gave an interview to the Daily Mirror that he had pranked the mayor of Cambridge, who was furious. But because the mayor of Cambridge was a stuffed shirt, this was taken as hilarious by all the undergraduates. And eventually, although he wanted to punish Cole, he was talked out of it by the dean of the school, like, no, you already look like an idiot. Don't go after this kid.
Because he's like the bad guy in some 80s school comedy, right?
Exactly, exactly.
Like, oh, you guys think you can put on the rock show that'll save the ski lodge? Good luck.
Well, so this is an era, this is peak English colonialism or UK colonialism, British colonialism, I guess we would say. And the following year, the HMS Dreadnought was launched as the absolute like cutting edge of technology, British Navy battleship, unlike any that had ever come before, the absolute power of the seas.
Is it like huge?
It's massive. I mean, it's called the Dreadnought because literally you would dread not
if you were in it.
If you were in this ship.
Hmm.
And in fact, the presence of the Dreadnought and then subsequent ships built in its style were emblematic of British global power, so much so that the Dreadnought became like the British Bulldog, a kind of universally respected symbol of not just British colonial power, but Britain in all its many splendors, all of the great gifts that Britain gave the world, symbolized by this unsinkable battleship.
I guess dreadnought was already a word meaning like a thick seafaring garment, because you would not fear the elements if you were wearing your toasty dreadnought. And so
the ship they was applied it named to the after ship the jacket. Well.
It was already a naval themed word that conveyed a lack of fear.
And it was for sure a thing where the crew of the dreadnought felt that this was the top assignment in the Royal Navy. They were extremely arrogant about their position. Mm. And Cole had a friend who was on the HMS Hawk, which was a slightly older ship, who was within the kind of already probably pranking culture of the Royal Navy, felt like the crew of the Dreadnought needed to be taken down a peg, and they were presumably all sitting around some Cambridge drinking club. And Hawk said, hey, you're famous, you know, Sultan of Zanzibar, you're famous for your pranks. Can you think of anything that you could do to make the Dreadnought look dumb. And so the Hawk can...
They're punching up.
Yeah. So the rest of the Navy can laugh at these stuffed shirts. Like the captain of the Dreadnought was Herbert Richman, who was like one of these Royal Navy officers that is kind of legendary. And I think they still study his writings on naval warfare. It was the flagship of Admiral William May, who commanded the Royal Navy later on. I mean, this is, you know, 10 years before, this is 5 years before World War One.
This is so ready to be a movie because it already has like good, likable naval officers and like pompous, ready to puncture naval officers. This is great.
And one of the commanders on the Admiral's staff was a man named Commander Willie Fisher, who was a first cousin of Adrian Stephen and his younger brother, Toby Stephen, and
therefore Virginia Woolf. Vanessa Bell. And again, it's their cousin who's on the Hawk or on the Dreadnought?
He's on the Dreadnought.
Okay.
Cole's friend is on the Hawk.
Got it.
And so this is, you know, too juicy a plum for Cole to leave alone. The Dreadnought had only recently, like, paid a visit to London, and supposedly a million people turned out to see the Dreadnought sail up the Thames.
It's big news.
Big news. So Cole recruits five friends. The artist Duncan Grant, who plays a major role in the Bloomsbury story that I'm going to tell in a future omnibus.
You're doing Duncan Grant foreshadowing.
I am, a little bit. A guy named Gary Ridley, who became a lawyer after leaving the, you know, or became a barrister. Guy Ridley, Gary Ridley. Gary Ridley, you know, worked at the truck plant here. Yeah. Anthony Buxton, and then Adrian Stephen and Virginia Woolf.
Virginia Woolf herself.
And they all went and acquired costumes of what they described as Abyssinia, which we know as Ethiopia. They're
just doing vaguely
Abyssinian
exotic what they think of as African Middle Eastern garb.
And then to really hammer home what a great omnibus episode this is, they then dressed in blackface. They painted their faces and their hands.
We're always disappointed when we get to the end of the show and nobody in history has done blackface.
Yeah, there's blackface involved here. And, you know, interestingly, we think of blackface as a sort of vaudeville American reference to slavery.
Right.
But blackface it has an ancient history. People have been painting themselves to look like other races for what one presumes are 1,000 years. But it has, or thousands of years, but it has a real place in British culture. So much so that there was a television show that still was on the air in 1978. In the UK, that featured
their Amos and Andy was worse than ours.
Yeah, blackface performers, and when there was a lot of pushback about it, like you can't possibly still be doing this, like a lot of people from the London entertainment world, prominent people came forward and said, no, it's not racist. It's not about that at all. It's all the argument that you get.
It's a tradition. Yeah.
No, this is part of our tradition. Like this isn't meant to be insulting. So they dress and they put on false beards. Virginia Woolf wearing a turban with her face painted like an Ethiopian.
Couldn't she just be a veiled woman of the...
No, because a veiled woman wouldn't have come on a trip of state like this. You wouldn't have brought your wives. No, and she's hilarious as an Abyssinian sultan. But, you know, she's got these big eyes and she's smaller than the rest of them by a fair margin, but you know.
Who's afraid of Virginia Woolf at improv? Everybody. Right. She turns out to be great.
And they send out a ton of telegrams kind of alerting alerting people in power that the Abyssinian royal family is arriving in London and what they really want to do is tour the Dreadnought. They send a telegram to the commander-in-chief of the Navy. They send telegrams to all these kinds of important people, sort of masquerading as Cole claimed he was Herbert Chemondelet, who worked in the Foreign Office, and they
is it that name Chumley? Does it look like Chalmondeley?
Yeah, Chalmondeley. Is it pronounced Chumley?
Yeah, they're so Chumley. In addition to their terrible blackface, their spelling is also depraved.
I had no idea that Chumley, who I know as a prominent character in American culture, that it was actually pronounced.
They have eight.
That
more,
way.
They add eight letters or something to it.
You know, Chumley is one of the characters on American Pawn Shop.
I assume he spells it the normal way.
I bet he does. Well, I mean, he's like probably spells it like chum that you would throw to a shark.
Oh yeah, L-E-E. He does not spell it Chalmundle or anything.
No, Chumley. Anyway, they contact someone at British Rail and demand a private coach for the trip from London down to Weymouth, where the ship is docked, and they are given a VIP private coach.
You don't have to give anybody a credit card number back then.
Nope, you just write a telegram from the Foreign Office, and they all board at Paddington Station. Presumably, everyone assumed that they were in London. I think when they mailed out the telegram, when they sent the telegrams, Cole reputedly went to a post office that he knew was staffed only by women because he assumed that they would be less likely to challenge him when he sent what is clearly a lunatic telegram.
Like a fraudulent telegram?
Yeah. And so they all take this private coach down to Weymouth. They are greeted with an honor guard.
Mm.
They could not conceive of what the flag of Abyssinia was, but they did have the flag of Zanzibar. And
leftover.
So they flew the flag of Zanzibar and also played the...
You're foreign. We found a foreign flag.
Yeah, played like the anthem of Zanzibar, which had they been the real... like kings of Abyssinia,
yeah,
they would have been super mystified. But, you know, the Royal Navy's like doing the best it can.
So there is a marching band. I love it.
They arrive on the ship. They're all speaking in a gibberish of their Etonian, Latin, and Greek, which weirdly, none of the old Etons or old Etonians on the ship recognized as a pastiche of Latin and Greek.
So it's not as racist as it could have been. They're not making up what to them is an African language.
Well,
they are in blackface.
A little bit. Because as they're walking around the ship, they are, whenever they express approval, they're being shown things. And they actually bring like medals. They try to give medals to the naval officers, like military decorations. But when they see something that they like on the ship, they all go, "Ah, oh, bunga bunga." Yes, boonga okay. Boonga.
That is about as racist as a two-syllable
yeah.
made-up word as you can get.
It goes to boonga boonga. And they're being translated, I think, again, Adrian is their translator and appears, you know, to be like listening intently to the boonga boonga and then saying like, oh, they really love the...
But he's also in blackface. He's not...
No. He's dressed as an Englishman.
He's their liaison.
He's from the Foreign Office. He's wearing a top hat.
Mr. Chumley.
And insanely, Commander Willie Fisher, the first cousin of Virginia Woolf...
Oh, he's not in on it.
Is not only not in on it, but doesn't recognize his cousins. And just like everybody goes along with it, they complete their tour and get into their private coach and lots of laughs all the way. And then the following day, Cole cannot help but tell the story to the Daily Mirror.
That's his MO, man.
Including publishing a photograph of all the Abyssinian royal family standing there on the deck of the dreadnought. And the dreadnought, you know, everyone is humiliated, and it was presented as a skewering of high and mighty English culture by this group of Cambridge, like gay coded modernist art.
They're bohemians.
Bohemians. Even though everybody is at the same exact social class, there weren't any. There was nobody there that didn't have three houses.
They're punching a cross.
But Bunga Bunga became the sort of the motto of the dreadnought.
Oh.
And during World War II, the HMS Dreadnought, in an extremely rare maneuver, actually sank a U-boat by ramming it. And when they got their letter of congratulations from the War Department, it closed with Bunga Bunga. And then it became like Bunga Bunga became a kind of World War I era, like I don't know about chant, but a kind of, you know, a symbol of, they reappropriated Bunga Bunga.
Navies be loving weird traditions, right?
Yes, they do.
Like, they're like, oh, we could make this a thing. Well, I can't get over the fact that, when is this, 1910?
Yeah.
How absurdly easy it must have been to do fraud back then. Like, you'd think every kind of chiseling and embezzling would have been already invented, but apparently, like, the system has so many holes that, you know, you can send a telegram from somebody who's not you and instruct military officers to do things they're not actually allowed to do, and, like, this must have been a golden age for anybody who came up with whatever the equivalent of check kiting was.
Well, we've done quite a few episodes about people over the years that started a new religion or sold shares in a diamond mine.
The what are the guys sprinkling the ground with gold or whatever.
But if you think about it, so much of our culture until very recently was run on the assumption that we were all following the same rules. Like 10 years ago, if you had said, well, 15 years ago, if you had said the president of the United States was going to accept a 747 from the Sultan of Oman.
Qatar.
Yeah. As a personal gift that he was going to use while president and then keep afterwards, it would have broken the world. Like, the New York Times would have literally caught on fire with outrage. And now we're like, oh, isn't there a... Oh, it turns out there's no law? I could swear there was a law.
It was just social cohesion, nobody enforces whatever law there was.
Do you remember the movie No Way Out with Kevin Costner?
Yeah.
Like, one of the major plot points was that every single little jewelry box and engraved pen that was given to a Foreign Service employee
had to go on a ledger.
Yeah, had to be registered and declared, and you couldn't keep it, and no one in the Foreign Service that had any dignity would keep an expensive gift. And apparently it wasn't an actual rule. I don't understand how norms, but at the time, I'm sure
it takes a grifter to create the realization.
Yeah,
and there's a hole.
And probably at this time, the lowest thing that Horace DeVere Cole could have imagined was to do something like this to profit from it.
Right.
Right. So the norm was, apparently it was okay to put, you know, dress Virginia Woolf as a king of Assyria, but not if you made a pound from it.
Maybe, I wonder if there were rules that would have kicked in if you would, like, I'm going to use these same mechanisms to actually get away with, you know, thousands of dollars of military materiel. Maybe at that point something would have kicked in, but...
Well, interestingly, at this time, flogging was still an accepted punishment in the Royal Navy, and failing to have these characters, they were not in the Navy and so could not be flogged, but they were symbolically flogged by what now would be an in-on-the-joke group of sailors from the Dreadnought.
There was no real flogging.
No real flogging. They symbolically flogged them all, except they didn't symbolically flog Virginia Woolf because she was a woman.
Did was it an effigy, or did they have to show up for their own symbolic flogging?
I think it might have been an air flogging.
but they were good sports about it. They're like, yeah, we'll come to our flogging.
No, I don't think they went to the flogging. They were sequestered back in their... Cambridge Drinking Club, or at this point probably had all dropped out of Cambridge.
But they won't even air flog Virginia Woolf.
No.
They're like, we enjoyed Mrs. Dalloway.
Well, once again, the standards, Like, sure, you can embarrass us in front of the world, but we're not going to flog a woman in effigy. Who do you take us for?
We're not brutes. And that concludes the Dreadnought Hoax. Entry 380.PS6831, certificate number 19722, in the omnibus. Futurelings, speaking of social cohesion breaking down, John's back on social media.
Yay, come find me, Lee!
John's back on Facebook somehow. We got a note from someone who was like, I'm catching up with Omnibus, I'm listening to an entry about how John's not on social media, but then I was interrupted by that from a post by John, a post from John, so yeah. I can't wait to see how this works out.
Yeah, well, a lot of suspense. It all worked out, and you know, interestingly, there are a lot of people who work at Facebook who listen to Omnibus, because once that episode aired, I got a lot of direct messages saying, I work in the department of Facebook where we block people like you, and I bet you I could flip a switch.
Where we block people like you. The air flogging department at Facebook. So we're at John Roderick and at Ken Jennings respectively on maybe the least bad social media sites we can find at Omnibus Project.
You are actually posting on Instagram, which you avoided doing for years.
I've got a book coming out. So they're like, hey, are you still on Facebook and X? I'm like, no, I'm not. So yeah, at Ken Jennings at Instagram. I think I only have like 10,000 followers, so you can really get in on the ground floor.
Get in on the ground floor. Be one of Ken's first 12,000 followers and get an
air flogging.
Get an air flogging from Ken Jennings.
I'll write down your name on a post-it and symbolically wave a little swatting wand above it, and I'll send you the phone video.
When you showed up at the bunker today, as you were standing on the porch waiting for me to put on my caftan and come to the door, once I arrived, you said, why is your neighbor waving at me?
And your neighbor was honking.
I looked out, and he not only was my neighbor honking and waving at you, but he was sitting in a minivan I've never seen before, parked in the parking strip in front of his own house. And we both briefly stared at him. He kept waving.
He kept honking.
And you were like, what's this about? And I honestly had no idea.
We still don't know. Maybe I have a kick me sign on my back or something.
Womp womp.
What is this? Can I open a package with this?
That is a Vietnam era K-bar survival knife, which you absolutely can open up.
Standard? Is it military issue?
Yeah, I got it at a Army Navy surplus store in about 1983.
And you say Vietnam era. You don't know which atrocities it has may or may not have done.
I mean, given that was 1982, maybe earlier, 82 at the latest.
I'm trying to open a box.
I would assume that it was Vietnam surplus, because everything in that store was either Korean or Vietnam War surplus.
Well, now it's doing good work of opening fan mail.
Yay!
Maybe this is the knife that Westmoreland used to open his fan mail. I don't know. You could also email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Physical items, of course, had to be sent through the U.S. mail.
You really are cutting into that. Are you practicing safe knife skills?
I am absolutely not, but I'm very close to getting out unscathed. It's not a great knife for this. Let's put it that way.
I'm nervous now.
We like suspense.
Okay. But I mean, looking,
it's a radio
watching
play
you
now.
Carve into that, I'm like, I don't know.
There we go.
If you were in the Boy Scouts, you might lose your chip and tote.
See, I survived. Oh, and this is for you. Look at all this work I've been doing on your behalf.
How do you know it's for me?
This is an envelope that says John.
Oh, but it's a huge box.
From Godlike Distributing. I assume everything under the letter that says John is also for you, so I'll pass that.
Godlike Distributing in Clifton, New York. Let's see. It's typed, my son Edward has neither goods nor cheese, but he works for Godlike Inc. promoting their totally wicked audio pedals.
Oh my gosh.
Is it a bunch of effects pedals for guitar?
Yes, it is.
I asked him to put together a sample pack for you. Hope you enjoy it. Your Omniversal Hyper Choral Pal, Mark.
A Patreon supporter, apparently.
Well, let's see what these pedals are, and let's get right down to... Okay.
One.
Okay. Two. Okay.
Here's a cable.
Good. Oh, I'm very excited by this.
TWA, Totally Wicked Audio.
Totally Wicked Audio.
And Wicked is spelled with a Y, which makes it even more badass.
Well, Godlike is also spelled with a Y.
Spell more. It's the new heavy metal umlaut. It's just replacing things with a Y.
It's like a striper Y. Oh, these are beautifully packaged. Look, they come in little velvet bags. They have fully what appear to be fully functioning instruction manuals.
Does it say what kind of pedal they are?
Well, let's see. This is called the Sidestep. The Sidestep is, the manual is called an in-flight manual. The Sidestep is, it's a low frequency oscillator. So it's like a kind of, I can see how fascinated you are by a low frequency oscillator. It's like
I think I'm mirroring the average listener here as these long pauses proliferate.
Here's the Dynamorph envelope harmonic generator. These are all like effects pedals that are going to get used on the next Long Winter's record, which I told you I was not going to talk about because I didn't want people to get excited about a thing that I couldn't deliver on.
What a scoop I just got here for the Daily Mirror.
And this is a power source, which I always need one. And then here's the big one, the Totally Wicked Audio. You know, you can imagine how excited I am, Ken. It's another, so these are all sort of envelope filter frequency modulators that are going to make my guitar do things like,
wow. What's the process here? Are you going to go noodle around with these and see what they do? And then maybe take them into the studio if you like them?
Yes.
Is it possible they replace things you already have? They're just nicer versions of those? Or could it be new effects that you've never like heard or tried?
I think that what TWA appears to be doing are making boutique pedals that do both emulate old modulators but also do completely new things. And most of the time, you know, you get things to do new things by adding
right
controls that didn't used to be there. Stack so you can up. You can turn things on and off that didn't used to be there. But like this one, the Purple Sparkle pedal has the following controls. Ready?
Okay.
There's a dip switch that switches between Kafka and Ovid.
Are those the two kinds of guitar playing?
The two kinds of guitar
Kafka
playing.
And Ovid?
Kafka and Ovid. It has a knob called Chrysalis, a knob called Ametaboli, a knob called Gestation. Then there's a Morph on and off. There's a Ecdysis. There's a Holometaboli and an Instar. So that does not give me an idea of what it does.
It explains everything.
Yeah.
Do you want your guitar playing to be Ovid, Metaboli, or Instar today?
I feel like I'm going to put it in Ovid and then turn up the Homo Metaboli, but also turn the Morph off.
I'll name a guitarist and you tell me whether he's Kafka or Ovid.
Okay, go. Can you name three guitars?
Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Oh, he's definitely Ovid.
Mark Knopfler.
Oh, pretty Kafka.
Oh, interesting. Eddie Van Halen.
Oh, Ovid.
Jack White.
Kafka.
Okay, there we go. Yeah. I think we figured this out.
Yeah.
The two kinds of guitarists there are. Can you name three guitarists? Come on.
Yeah, no, you did great.
Thank you. I was working on that. You can send us things. Did I see the email address? I did, right? You could also, the best way to support the show was to send John guitar pedals. Because listen to all the free advertising they just got.
Well, the Sidestep here has like a knob that goes where you can choose the waveform. And
does it go to 11?
Well, there's like more kinds of waveform than I knew existed.
The second best way to support the show, however.
Yeah, this doesn't benefit Ken really at all, except, you know, in all the fun he's going
to
have.
Second best way to support the show is to send me old horror comics. The third best way to support the show is to go to patreon.com/omnibusproject. And, you know, I think a lot of you at this point are getting tired of this point in the show. You think, I always hear this, and I never actually do it, and things have been fine for me.
I don't know.
I think...
But how long can that last?
Think about all the bad things that have happened, and ponder which of them could be because you did not become an omnibus Patreon supporter.
Oh, that had never occurred to me, but it's the butterfly flapping its wings problem.
That's right. How many of your ills would have gone away if you had access to, say, 60-odd free addenda shows, early ad-free access to the weekly entry, and then as the amount of your contribution goes up, so too does your reward. It's really just like religious practice.
All we would have needed is one person who is not listening to the addenda, but could have been listening to the addenda, to have been so inspired by the addenda that they changed the world in some way.
Just thinking about the unenriched life you've been leading. That does imply that there's content in the addenda so good that it will motivate world-changing stuff.
But you never know who's going to get what from what, right? So somebody, we might think, oh yeah, whatever. And they look back at and say, you know, that was the moment that I decided to dedicate my life to pranking. And that's what made, oh, actually, this is a mainline episode. So that could happen to anybody.
That's true. Whatever happens in the end, it's got to be more interesting than this. But you won't know until you get behind the curtain and join the apostles.
That's right.
I mean, am I implying that the addenda shows are gay? They're not gay.
I think the whole show is a little ambiguous.
Our show is queer-coded. It's queer culture, for sure.
It's
two straight white men talking about old military stuff is queer culture now.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely like higher sodomy.
We did talk about Virginia Woolf.
That's right. Pretty gay.
We make sure one queer icon comes up per show. That's our promise to you.
The omnibus promise.
The famous omnibus promise. Futurelings, if you want to complain about anything I'm saying, the place to do that is go to facebook.com/futurelings. Find other like-minded sorts who will agree that whatever I just said was out of bounds. But then if the comments get too mean, I'll probably just delete them.
God bless us, everyone. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We had no idea that this show was going to be this long.
Like, but it would last this long, or that this entry would go this long?
You're talking about that omnibus would last this long? Yeah. We knew that would happen.
Probably both.
We hope and pray that this episode ends, and that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. So if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.